Over the course of 80 or so episodes, we've talked to several theoretical physicists turned technologists, but today's is the first to turn a background researching chaos theory and gravitational waves into a long-standing career at the Center of Programming and Education. After doing an undergrad in physics at Harvard and a PhD in physics at Caltech, and then doing postdoc research in, you guessed it, physics, Michael Hartl turned his science background into founding roles at several tech companies of his own creation, including Quark Sports, Insoci, and his current one, Learn Enough. Along the way, he's published 10 plus books on tech and programming, including the nearly ubiquitous Ruby on Rails tutorial, which of course we'll link in the show notes. As if that's not enough, he's written his very own manifesto, not the crazy kind like that guy up in Montana, but the one called the Tau Manifesto, showing why the number pi really isn't all it's cracked up to be. Stay tuned as we catch up with Michael Hartl.
You're listening to the Developmentor podcast, hosted by Grant Ingersoll. We have one goal on the show, to help you build a successful career in tech, no matter where you're from or where you're going. We do this by showcasing interesting people working across a variety of roles in tech and deep dive into their why. If you want to learn more, please visit our website at developmentor.com or follow us on Twitter at @developmentor.
Show, Michael. Great to have you here.
Great to be here.
Yeah, and obviously I want to get into that whole, being a math nerd, I want to make sure we talk about pi and tau and all of that, but why don't we kick things off, you know, looking at your profile, I think before we get into the tech side, before we get into the math, you know, you've got this deep, long love affair, it looks like, with physics, and I'd really love how you got into that field, what drove you to, as I like to say, get all the degrees.
Yeah, no, it's too many degrees, maybe. But physics is a beautiful subject. I still stay in touch with it, and I read things. You know, I'm reading a couple of books that are, you know, written for physicists. That it's fun to kind of just stay in touch with that part of my life. And it's the kind of thing you never really lose it, because it's a transformative experience to study a subject for that long. And I kind of got into it through astronomy originally. I got interested in amateur astronomy when I was a kid. And then that led to looking at the dynamics of planets. And that led to the more mathematical side of things. So then I went all the way through in physics and, like you mentioned, undergrad, graduate school, and postdoc. But when I was in grad school, I got interested in entrepreneurship. So I was pretty sure, even as I was finishing up my degree, that I was going to be going in a different direction. And then originally I was planning on becoming a physics professor, you know, working as a professional physicist, but I got interested in the idea of starting companies. And so that led naturally in a different direction. Once I made that decision, it was like that set a whole bunch of things in motion that have led me to where I am today.
Was there a particular event, like in school, like were you in a club, you met some friends, was there anything in particular while you were in school that kind of put you on that path?
You know, it's interesting to ask that. I'm not sure if there was any one event, but I will say that I was in graduate school during the like late 90s, early 2000s tech stuff. Like there was the tech bubble and then the crash. So it was something people were paying a lot of attention to. And, you know, I mean, I remember when Google was new and I thought, should I drop out of grad school and move to Mountain View or Palo Alto? Maybe they might even have been Palo Alto at the time to go work for this company, because it was just like qualitatively better than any other search engine I'd ever seen. As it turns out, I should have done that. I mean, one of the lessons that I've learned as an entrepreneur is that you can never predict these things 100%. And like everyone has stories like this. In fact, one of my high school classmates went to grad school at Stanford with the founders of Google and probably could have been an early employee there. But at the time, it's like there was no money in search in 1998. Like, why would you do that? So everyone has stories like that of like these giant missed opportunities, because it's extremely hard to tell at the time.
I mean, I remember I kind of graduated and went into the work world around the same time, and I've had the same question, and, you know, it all works out in the end. So you can't kick yourself too much there. So then I'm curious, you know, I mean, I've met a lot of physicists, you know, especially physics kind of, let's call it, I don't know, post 1990, maybe even earlier, was primarily a lot of computational simulations. I know my very first job in programming was effectively doing physics work in Fortran. I'm curious, you know, where along the way did you pick up the tech side of it, the programming side of what then later formed your career and your work in like web development and that kind of stuff?
Yeah, well, you know, I started off with computers pretty early. I mean, I think we had a PC Junior back in the early days of personal computing, and I learned BASIC on that. A bunch of my family members got together and bought me a computer in high school that I used when I took computer science in high school. But I actually don't have much of a background in computer science per se. I don't have much more than like high school computer science, and I took a semester in college, but I don't have like an academic background in computer science, which I actually sometimes regret. Like, there are things I don't understand that I wish I did. But I have been programming and fiddling with computers for a long time. I didn't actually feel like I was really getting good at computers until like senior year of college. Like, it took a while for me to gain confidence actually in computing. And even now I still feel like I'm okay, but I'm like, I know people who are just next level. I mean, I am not next level when it comes to the computing side of things. Your guess is right though, that my work in physics involved a lot of computation. When I was an undergraduate, it was image processing. I worked at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics in a solar and stellar X-ray group, analyzing X-ray images of the sun. And then I also did a summer research fellowship with Caltech in that same field. So that was a lot of writing programs to do image processing. And then in graduate school, like, as you mentioned, I went to Caltech. Having been there for a couple of summers, I really liked it. I grew up in Southern California, so it was nice to be back home. And I did a lot of computational work as part of my dissertation too. So it was kind of a numerical integrator for a couple of different models for a black hole in spiral, and figuring out what the gravitational waves from those orbits might look like. And that integrator was in C++, actually the first version in C, and then I rewrote it in C++. And then there was a bunch of glue that was written initially in Perl and then in Python. And then I had a bunch of Mathematica on the front end for visualizing stuff. So there was a lot of computation. And actually, for a semester, I did teach a course on computational physics. So it's kind of funny because I don't really feel qualified to talk about that subject. But like, I feel like I did a decent job teaching a semester of computational physics. Like, so how bad can I be? This is actually one of the advantages of having a PhD in physics. Like, if I'm bad at something, I'm like, wait a minute, maybe this thing is just hard. Maybe I shouldn't beat myself up about not being able to get this, because maybe it's just hard because I do have a PhD in physics. So there's a bound on how dumb I can be in this thing. So maybe it's just a difficult thing to do. That's actually pretty nice. But yeah, so there was like a bunch of computing in my life, and going back to when I was a little kid, it wasn't until I got interested in starting a company that I got into web development. And I generally felt like, well, this is a good skill to have as someone who's interested in starting companies. And it didn't occur to me when I did that, that my first successful company would be teaching people web development.
I love that. And I do want to talk about Learn Enough here in a moment, but you hinted at a few of these other companies in between. And, you know, your profile strikes me very much, you know, I think you mentioned this with your like of entrepreneurship, but, you know, your profile is very much just one of paving your own way, founder, co-founder, principal, on your own as a consultant. I mean, it's pretty much Michael working and building his own companies all along. Like, what are some of the things that are driving that? When did you pick that up and recognize that in yourself? And you know, walk me through some of those early founding stories, especially like Quark Sports and being on your own as a consultant.
I do like to do my own thing. And I've never really had a normal job, which, you know, has a downside too, but it's tough out there on your own sometimes. But I do like working on my own projects. And out of grad school, I started a company. It was a fantasy sports company with one of my longtime friends. And we were just like 10 years too early. This is another common lesson in the entrepreneur game, is that one of the common failure modes is that you're too early. In fact, it's more common to be too early than too late. People are more worried about being too late, but being too early is more common and probably more dangerous. So we started a company that it was basically weekly fantasy sports games back when everything else was season long. And that has now become something that's a big industry. But at the time, the sports leagues were actually pretty hostile to fantasy sports. They felt like it was too close to gambling, and to the point where the National Football League Players Association, the NFLPA, was actually suing fantasy companies, fantasy sports companies, for using the players' names without permission. So it was a very hostile environment. And the truth is that we kind of started the first company we thought to do. And that's generally not a good idea. I think that you spent more time thinking about what we were really good at and what the market might have wanted. We might have found our way actually to the kind of thing I'm doing now, because both my co-founder for that company and I had been very successful instructors as graduate students at Caltech. So I was in the physics department, he was in the math department. And that's actually where I ended up going with my with entrepreneurship. But it took me a while to get there. One of the things I ask people when they pitch an idea to me and they have an idea for a company, and which certainly I would have given myself this advice back then, is what unfair advantages do you have? In other words, why are you the right person or the right founding team to start this particular company? Because there are lots of great ideas out there, but we didn't really have any advantages in that particular field, in the field of fantasy sports. We had a few, but you know, nothing substantial. It took me a while to figure out as an entrepreneur to that what I should be doing is taking that the teaching and writing skill set that I developed in grad school and applying it to product creation.
Yeah, I love that. And I think that's a theme I often see on this show, right? The thing that ultimately often unlocks for a lot of folks is this idea that there's these different pieces of the puzzle that all come together and then leads to that. And so in many ways, like those early lessons, you know, led you to that, you know? And so it's sure, it's easy to say you have regret, but in many ways, like you wouldn't be where you are now if you hadn't been through it, right?
On the one hand, I don't want to sugarcoat it and like try to rationalize failed startups and saying, well, you know, it couldn't have worked out better. I mean, it could have worked out better. And I feel like this is sound advice that if you're interested in starting a company, you should look for something that you're especially good at or where you have connections or you have domain expertise that other people don't have. There should be some sort of insight that you understand. In fact, if you look at like a Y Combinator's application, I actually don't know if they've tweaked this or not, but for the Y Combinator Entrepreneur Program, which I'm sure a lot of your audience has heard of, has invested in a huge number of very successful startups, including Stripe, Dropbox, Reddit, Airbnb, and so on. And one of the questions they asked their applicants, or at least they did, was like, what do you understand about this industry that other people don't? And I think that's really important to have some special insight. And then even more than that, if possible, have some particular connections or domain expertise, or so on and so forth.
So I'm curious, you mentioned a couple of times, you know, perhaps without picking at a scab or a scar here, but, you know, share some of those lessons you learned from, you know, which in your own words were failed startups. What were kind of some of the hard lessons that got beyond just like, I probably didn't have domain expertise. That's clearly one you've mentioned. Any others that come to mind?
You know, let me think about this. Well, I didn't really understand how nasty timing can be. You really want to find something where like the time is ripe for the startup that you're doing. And that's pretty tricky to figure out. And I actually can give an anecdote in this vein. So I mentioned Y Combinator. Reading the essays of Paul Graham was very influential in the early 2000s. Paul Graham was one of the founders of Y Combinator, had quite a bit of success as an entrepreneur. He sold the company to Yahoo, and then had written a bunch of essays that ended up sort of mutating into, I think he built an audience and then eventually realized, oh, you know, I can actually start an investment fund. And so I actually went through the Y Combinator program in 2008. And as part of that, there are speakers who come in. And again, I don't know, it's changed a lot. This was the really early days. Like literally Paul made dinner for us. He was like the cook for our weekly dinners to give you a sense of the size of it, what it was at the time. So it was like still very, very small. Now it's become a huge operation, but we would have speakers come in and everyone had the same story. Like the story arc was always the same. We did this one thing, we did this other thing, we were about to die as a company, and then something amazing happened and we succeeded as a company. There was always some like huge, like really unexpected, unpredictable, or implausible thing that happened. It doesn't happen in literally every case, but that was one of the patterns. And what's interesting is that almost nobody saw or like acknowledge the role that this sort of randomness came to play, except for one, Mark Andreessen, the creator of the original web browser, a founder of Netscape, and now an investor in Andreessen Horowitz. He was the one speaker who acknowledged this. And he said that luck is a huge factor, and a lot of luck comes down to timing. Mm-hmm. And he specifically mentioned something that, this is like old school, it's like the 80s, there was this idea of a local area network or LAN. I actually only barely even know what this is, but there was this idea in the 80s, apparently, according to Mark Andreessen's telling, that there was going to be a year of the LAN, and that any companies that were, whatever, tapped into this trend would become really successful. And so basically, for several years in a row, it was like 1983 was going to be the year of the LAN. All of the LAN startups mm-hmm. that year failed. And then 84, and whatever it was, like then 1 year actually was the year of the LAN, and those companies succeeded. And so it's really hard to time that. And yet I think most entrepreneurs underestimate its importance. And so that's something that I would advise people if they're interested in the entrepreneurial path, is to look for something whose time is right. And so that certainly wasn't the case with the fantasy sports startup. And then my one Combinator startup, you mentioned it was called InSoshi. It never was really a company. It was an open source social network that my co-founder and I built kind of as an example of what we could do. And we actually did attract the attention of some investors and were in the process of raising a couple million dollars. We essentially would have been a Yammer competitor. Yammer was like an internal company, like Twitter/Facebook, that actually did quite well. It got acquired by Microsoft. And so we would have been in that space. And so basically we were looking to raise money. This was in like the fall of 2008. And so if you remember the fall of 2008, it was basically the worst time to raise money, like until now.
That's when we raised money for LucidWorks.
Yeah, if we'd started looking for money about like 2 or 3 months earlier, even, we probably would have closed around. And this isn't one of these things. This isn't sour grapes. This isn't rationalization. I was tired of it. I was sick of what we were working on. I was ready to move on to something else. And so we eventually got what's sometimes called the Silicon Valley no, which is, we'd be happy to invest in you if you could show us a mature product with traction. In between there, I had written a book. One of my friends from Caltech, who actually we knew each other through the singing group there, we were both in the Caltech Glee Club. His name is Ari Prochaska. And so he was actually involved in web development in the early, early days, like in the, you know, like literally like 93, 94, 95, when the web was just starting. And he had written a blog post about Ruby on Rails in like 2005 or 6 or whatever, when Rails was still pretty new. A book publisher approached him about maybe writing a book on the subject. And I actually don't even remember exactly how he'd come across my writing or why he knew that I did writing, but somehow he knew that. And so he asked me if I was interested in co-authoring a book on Ruby on Rails, which I did not know at the time. I had done a little bit of it, but I basically learned Rails. I mean, this is actually a time honored tradition in academia, among other places. If you want to learn a subject, you should teach it. I mean, I already knew web development like reasonably well. And so like I understood all of the pain points. I'd written my own sort of half-baked web framework in Python for my first startup. And this was before Django existed, for example. So that wasn't an option. And if people, you know, who are maybe like the next generation or half generation younger, maybe don't remember how primitive the web development tools were. But even just like persisting a session was really tricky. Everything was like a content management system. There were very few things operating at the right level of abstraction, where it gave you all of the tools you needed to do web stuff, like redirects, persisting sessions and cookies and so on, but had a kind of generality that let you write an arbitrary application that could do pretty much anything. And so, you know, because I'd done my own half-baked version of this, I appreciated the problems that Rails was solving in a more structured way. So anyway, I picked it up pretty quickly in the process of writing this book. So the funny thing is, we ended up calling it RailSpace, which, to give you a sense of how long ago this was, with a reference to MySpace. And the book was basically a Rails tutorial that built a sample application that was a social network. And the publisher actually wanted to call it the Ruby on Rails tutorial. And I thought, that's such a boring, generic name. Like, we should do something more interesting than that. And that turned out to be fortunate, because then some years later, after my Y Combinator startup shut down, the name was available for me to do on my own. That was really how I got started. That was my first successful venture, was the Rails tutorial, which was actually, honestly, even then a little bit risky. I mean, I felt like I understood the market. I was a consumer of web development, you know, tech education, particularly Rails education. So like I felt like I knew the market, and I felt like the kind of thing that I wanted to make didn't exist. actually, with hindsight, I realized I got luckier than I realized even at the time.
Yeah, I want to dig in on that because there's some fascinating things. I want to put a pin for our listeners on two things that you mentioned earlier. One is the timing aspect. Go back just a little bit, and I would encourage our listeners to go listen to our episode with Adam Chair, the founder of Siri, and he talks a lot about his approach to timing. So just for our listeners to tie back there. And then literally my last interview, Michael, was with Simon Wilson, one of the co-creators of Django. So it's like all coming full circle for me right now. But so I encourage our listeners to go listen to both of those episodes for some alternative views, or maybe complimentary views is probably the better way of saying it. So picking up a little bit more on this thread, you know, like I've written a tech book. Tech books are hard. There's not a lot of margin in them. I know, you know, there was a heyday for tech books again, kind of back in the early 2000s. I know a friend of mine who wrote a book on servlets of all things in the early 2000s. I mean, he cleared like seven figures off of that book, which is just crazy nowadays. And so, but you know, at the same time, like you've kind of gone all in, and I want to read something for our listeners real quick to set the stage about Learn Enough, which is your company behind this. Cause I think if I was doing my research right, and I read your profile, you had this phrase in here. You wanted to take an approach to building and crafting a company that you call the medium risk, medium reward product business. So as compared to the startups, which were kind of all in, you know, you've done this groundwork of building this awesome resource called the Ruby on Rails tutorial, and then now you've created this Learn Enough. So bring me into that world.
The medium risk, medium reward referred specifically to the Rails tutorial. I would say Learn Enough is actually something that is a different category, and it's something I think it's really gained prominence in the past, you know, maybe 5 years or so, which is a bootstrap startup. But Learn Enough is actually a startup version of the Rails tutorial. The Rails tutorial was just me doing my thing, you know, contracting out a few things, but it was pretty much just a one person company. But it did well enough that I realized, like, I want to expand this out. And so then I brought in a couple of co-founders who have now been involved in pretty much all aspects of the business, one of whom has been the co-author on a couple of the titles as well. This company, the Learn Enough company, is definitely designed to be more of a traditional startup, but in the bootstrap mold, so that we can grow more slowly. We don't have to, you know, succeed on a, you know, 2-year timeline, that we can just keep growing the business organically as makes sense. Now, I'm not opposed to taking money as a company, but it does come with a lot of responsibilities. And I think a lot of people underestimate the cost of those things. But the way it goes, if we were growing so fast that we couldn't keep up, and that if we only had an injection of like $1 million or $2 million, which sounds like a huge amount of money, but for, you know, a startup, it's like, it's not a giant amount of money. If you can turn it into a $100 million company, you know, I would definitely consider that, but that's not where we are. We're growing organically, which I really like. And I like not being beholden to investors. I like being able to grow at the pace that makes sense for us.
Yeah, well, and that kind of goes back to some of that earlier theme you have of, you know, you like to go your own path, which is, it's totally valid. Tell me more about Learn Enough and kind of how you've brought all these different ideas together into this platform.
Sure. Well, it really started with the Rails tutorial. And so the way the Rails tutorial began was, you know, come out of Y Combinator, I was trying to figure out what to do next. I wanted to do a medium risk, medium reward business. I was influenced in part by Tim Ferriss's book, The 4-Hour Workweek. So I wanted a product business. And so I thought, well, what do I know how to do? And I realized, well, I've written a book on Rails before. I wrote a Ruby on Rails tutorial. And I looked at the educational market at the time. And based on my experience teaching physics at Caltech, I had an intuition for how big a subject was. And I thought, you know, this is like what would be called a one-term class at Caltech. But Caltech it's like quarters without a summer. So it's just like three terms, like three 10-week terms, basically. And so I thought, this is about a one-term class. So it would be like 20 or so hours of recitation section and maybe some lectures. So like, that's how big the subject is. So if you were going to make a book, and then the key part was adding the videos too. Like if I were to make a video series that's just basically me teaching web development and recording it as a product, I feel like it should be like 10 to 20 hours of video. And there wasn't anything of that size at the time, at least in the Rails market. And I'd also cultivated some relationships. I'd been going to conferences, which is something I'd definitely recommend in general. And so I knew some people in the Rails community who had expressed support privately, who said, you know, this sounds like a really good idea. And like, it turned out to be good. Like, I'd be happy to make a blog post about it or like help you kind of get it off the ground. And then the final piece was that I did some research on Google AdWords, where you could do a search on like, put in search terms and find out roughly how many people were searching for it. So that gave me a sense of what the market size was. And I thought it's big enough. Like if I have a nice SEO kind of company, it's Ruby on Rails tutorial, right? That RailsTutorial.org, something with like very friendly for SEO, and you know, get my search engine optimization game down. I felt like that was probably like a business. Like at the time I just wanted to stop running out of money all the time. I was tired of running out of money all the time. I just wanted to make enough that I didn't have to worry about paying the rent, like, you know, 3 months down the line, which is where I'd been, you know, in grad school. You don't make much money, and I, you know, a couple times burned through my savings. And it was really stressful, so I was tired of that. And so I didn't want like all or nothing. I wanted something where, hey, maybe it starts off as like a few thousand dollars a month and I can grow it over time.
Yeah, something you can do on the side, or because you've done some consulting work too, I think.
Yeah, I did a small amount of consulting just as kind of an interim thing. But I was close to full time on the Rails tutorial for the better part of a year, which honestly is a little bit more risk than I would generally recommend. But the good news is that it worked, and especially once I launched the videos, that it was like it was a good business, you know, for a single person. But I mentioned previously the role of luck and timing, and I think I definitely underestimated the role of this. As it so happened, the first full edition of the Ruby on Rails tutorial came out just around the time that Rails 3 dropped. And so Rails 3 was a big update. It was much more mature software. It did a lot of things better. It was faster. And it reignited the Rails educational market in a way that I had not anticipated. Now, I don't actually even recall if that was a factor in my thinking, but it definitely should have been. Because without the boost given by Rails 3 coming out almost exactly the same time, just a few months before, I don't think it would have been nearly as successful. So there was definitely some luck there. And, you know, with hindsight, I probably could have anticipated that a little better. So that's the kind of thing that if you're looking at making a product or looking at making a company, think about like what sort of trends are there that you think are going to hit in the next like year or 6 months or whatever on the timeline where you can actually have a product ready for that market. That did well. And then I basically just kind of ran out for a while and then realized that there were all these prerequisites to the Rails tutorial. Complete newbies were like going through the tutorial, which I was amazed that they were able to do it because it's really quite difficult, but they were doing it. And actually quite a few non-technical people were reading it, which is kind of strange. But like bootstrapped entrepreneurs, people, I asked them like, why are you reading the Rails tutorial? Like, I'm glad that you like it, but and they would come up to me at conferences and be like, yeah, I'm the CEO of my bootstrap startup and I really like your Rails tutorial. Like, that's awesome. Like, but why are you reading the Rails tutorial? And what they'd say is that they wanted to know how tech worked. They wanted to be able to talk with their tech people. They just wanted to have a foundation in web development specifically and sort of tech generally. And the Rails tutorial is like, you know, quite self-contained for, you know, in its niche. But I realized that there was a need for essentially all of the prerequisites. And so I'd also established kind of a brand with the Rails tutorial. The Rails tutorial is now, it's like almost 900 pages. Like it's like a substantial document. And I did not want the expectation that a tutorial with my name on it would be that sort of comprehensive introduction to something. What I need is like a meta brand. I need something where I can make multiple titles and something that manages expectations, that people aren't going to expect to get everything. And I was actually inspired in this regard by something you may have heard of. It says Zed Shaw's Learn Something the Hard Way. It's like Learn Python the Hard Way. So that's a really nice brand because you can slot in different subjects. And it tells you right up front, this is a hard way. So you can't do Learn Python the Hard Way and complain that it's hard. Like he told you in the title that it was hard. So this is how I came up with Learn Enough. And I thought, I'll teach you to learn enough to be dangerous on a given subject. And I'm not going to teach you everything. So if you say, well, hey, I took your Learn Enough JavaScript to be dangerous, but I didn't learn everything about JavaScript. Like, didn't tell you I was going to teach you. This wasn't the definitive guide to JavaScript, right? This was Learn Enough JavaScript to be dangerous. Like, that's the kind of thing I could run with. And I went to, one of the domain search terms. You know, anyone who's done web startups knows how hard it is to find a good domain. Right. So I'll talk to people who are not in that space. They'll say, what about such and such.com? Like, no, that's fake. How do you know? Like, trust me, that's too good a domain not to be taken. But so I actually went looking for learn enough to, it's not a great domain. I went looking for learn enough to be dangerous. I typed learn enough, and it was one of these interactive with like a JavaScript callback or whatever that interactively told me that it was available. And I looked at it. Now I have a good intuition for this. So sometimes I would type in a domain and it would tell me it was available. And I would say, no, you are wrong. This is not available. This is a false positive. And I would click through. And in fact, I would be right. I was wrong though. I looked at learnenough.com. I said, there's no way that that domain is available. I clicked through. It was available.
So it's not even like a parked domain that somebody was squatting on.
It was just straight up available. So I'm like, all right, $15 a month or whatever it was, like $15 a year. I'm like, yes, I'm in. I don't even remember what year I did that, but it was pretty far in advance of even when the first Learn Enough tutorial came out. It was like several years ahead of time. I just like, I had in my head, this is the kind of thing I would like to do, to make a series of tutorials that are essentially the prerequisites to web development, again, specifically, but also that are sort of more broad-based in tech. And that's really how Learn Enough was born. And so I think it literally starts with Learn Enough command line to be dangerous. And like, there are no prerequisites to that other than you can use a computer. And, you know, if I say install some software, you're not going to freak out. But like, if you can install software on your computer, if you can, you know, touch type, maybe not even that, you can actually start learning Unix command line. And then it builds up from there all the way through. And it's now the real tutorial kind of, you know, part of the same, you know, it's under the broader umbrella. And so basically we've got all the prerequisites and plus, you know, plus some little nice detours. Like there's a tutorial on CSS and layout that I co-authored with Lee Donahoe, one of my co-founders. And I mean, he was the first author on that because I don't know CSS very well, but so he took the lead on that. And it's just a beautiful book on and video series and online course now on not just cascading style sheets, not just the design part, but you actually build a real website with a static site generator. And it's the kind of thing where you don't technically need to do that to get through, say, the Rails tutorial, but it's just such a nice thing. It's like you start to understand, for example, why it's valuable to be able to take components of a website and reuse them. So you've got the same navigation on every page. When I was first learning about the web, in the mid 90s, I had no idea. Like you go to a website and like the navigation is the same on every page. Like I said, there's no way that they're just copying and pasting that from page to page. There's got to be some like program to do that. And so I love now to introduce people to that idea because it was one of the first real aha moments for me in programming generally, but especially in web development, realizing, oh, you have like a template where all of that stuff is like in individual files. And if you want to change the menus, you just need to change it in that one spot. And there's a program that like kind of weaves it all together and delivers it as a web page. That series of tutorials, it's not linear, but it's like it builds on itself in the same direction. And pretty much can get people wherever they want to go in terms of like either start, you know, looking if they want to become a front end designer, developer, then they can basically stop wherever they want. But if they want to go all the way through, they can get through the real tutorial and, you know, actually have a professional grade web development experience under their belt.
Well, and I imagine too, I mean, in many ways, the model fits what is an increasingly common archetype for engineers, which is, you know, this T-shaped where you're pretty broad on most things, but then you can go deep. And so in some ways, you know, Learn Enough covers all the broad things, and then you can go really deep on something like Rails. Well, and in many ways, it makes sense because, you know, given how fickle the industry is at times, you know, things come and go, Rails in and out of favor, like you said, 3 was a big hit. But there's all these other frameworks and you needed something that wasn't just a one hit. And so that actually kind of begs a question too, is, you know, like the publishing industry is pretty challenging in tech, right? You know, traditionally pretty low margin, but it sounds like you've brought in other components to it, the video, the coursework, et cetera.
I had an unusual deal. So I actually wrote the Rails tutorial on my own using my own publishing system. And it was designed so that I didn't need a publisher necessarily. I wanted to be able to do it on my own. But then I did end up signing a deal with the publisher of my first Rails book to publish the Ruby on Rails tutorial and the videos as well. And so I have an unusual deal where like I actually have the rights to publish it on my own website and so on. And then, you know, they've got their channels as well. It's done well in terms of the royalties, but I've definitely made a lot, like way more in direct sales. And so, and for the Learn Enough tutorials, those are all just on my own because it just, you do give up some control when you sign with a publisher. Our Amazon copies of a bunch of the books right now, and I would have to yank those, which I don't want to because I can update them. Like literally, I probably push an update to the LearnF tutorials that are on Amazon. Like, all of them will eventually be there. It just hasn't been a priority, but I push updates to those like fairly often. Like I think literally I did one today. In fact, I got an email because there was a node module that had been deprecated in chapter 10 in LearnF JavaScript to be dangerous. And so I updated that this morning and I pushed the update immediately to the LearnF website and then uploaded the Amazon version, and it'll be live within hours. You know, and you can't do that if you're dealing with sort of the more traditional publishing. Even the electronic version, it takes a lot of time for them. And I mean, I think it's a part of it is that they've been around a long time. They have processes that are maybe a little older. And so I feel like I really like being as nimble as we are. Like the company LearnF is technically built on top of a publishing platform that's actually the parent company. And we didn't know if it would be successful on its own, and there wasn't a big enough market for a publishing platform. But we have this publishing platform. I'm going to write a blog post about this. I have everything aliased to the letter D for deploy. I have a deploy script, and it's just like an auto detect. Like, is this a book? Is this a Jekyll website that needs to get pushed to GitHub but isn't built locally? Is it a Jekyll website that has to be built locally before it's pushed? Is it a Rails website? I just like, when I'm done and ready to push something, I just type D and it does everything else. It's like, it does a git pull, so it makes sure it's up to date. I finish my changes, I type D. So the first thing it did is it switched to a branch. It threw off a copy of the Mobi format for Kindle. So I could upload and then switch to the master branch, built the HTML, uploaded that so the website would be up to date right away, and then built HTML, EPUB, Mobi, and PDF, and then uploaded those to the website. So like the next person who bought the book from learnf.com got the updated version within like a minute. And so that's the kind of thing I really do like having my own publishing pipeline. And then you mentioned, like, I think if you really want to turn it into a business, it really is hard to make it just writing books. I suppose it can be done, but having more structured courses built on top of things with your text and with a video, that's where we've gone. And so the LearnF core business is what we call All Access, and it's a subscription where you get everything. You get, you know, online courses with videos, text, and including the Rails tutorial. That has become the foundation of the business. We make maybe 2/3 of our income from subscriptions and about 1/3 from product sales. So like they're both worth doing for sure. But I think that in order to make it in the content business, you do need to do something in addition to that, as you mentioned. Like the old model was like become a consultant, but I don't think that's good.
Yeah, and they all kind of sell against each other, you know, like one's the lead for the other, et cetera. Michael, you know, kind of coming up towards the end of the show here, a couple of questions. You know, so as you reflect back, what's been the most surprising thing about your career to date?
Starting your own company is really difficult. And I mean, it's kind of funny. I have a universal advice for it, which is don't do it, because the people who should start a company are going to say, I'm going to do it anyway. I'm not going to listen to that guy's advice. Whereas for the other people who shouldn't start a company, they'll take the advice. It is really quite difficult. And it's a good idea to start something a little smaller. I'm really glad that I found something like the Rails tutorial that I could build up from, like, you know, having an income stream and then building up from there. I've been surprised by just how difficult it can be to make it.
Yeah, I think you hit on some really key things. I've done the startup VC funded thing, and then like this thing is my own little baby that I'm just doing on the side. And there's trade-offs to both, so I'm glad you highlighted that. And so yeah, let's talk about the Tao thing. And you know, my question for you, Michael, is what do you got against the number pi? I mean, what did it ever do to you?
Yeah, that's funny. So this is actually right around the same time. Like I took time out in 2010 when I was writing a Rails tutorial. I basically blocked out a month to write the Tao manifesto. And I'll give you the short version is that the defining length of a circle is the radius. You define a circle as the set of all points, a given distance, the radius from the center. And so that gives you a circumference, the circle has a length. The two length scales for the circles. And so if you want to get a number that characterizes that, you should divide the circumference by the radius. And that's not what pi is. Pi is the circumference divided by the diameter. And that the diameter is twice the radius. And that factor of two then just shows up everywhere. So if you look at equations in math books or physics books, there are just two pi's floating around everywhere. And so like, what's going on? And that two, what's going on? So that two is the conversion between circumference between radius and diameter. And so I read a wonderful little essay called Pi is Wrong back in the early 2000s by a mathematician named Bob Pillay. And it was, it made the case that, essentially if we had another constant that was equal to 2 pi, that it would be much more convenient in all these ways. And it wasn't taking off though as a, like, as a movement. And so this is the kind of a timing thing. I saw an opportunity. People were talking about this idea on like Reddit and Hacker News and so on. And I thought, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to write a manifesto. I'm going to make this a thing that people know about. And it was weird. It actually took me a long time to figure out when I should launch it. But with hindsight, it's completely obvious because Pi Day is on March 14th, 314. Like, this obviously has to launch on Tau Day, June 28th. So June 28th, 6/28/2010, I launched this thing and it took off. And it's kind of funny because like both of the things I'm known for, if people know me for anything, were like that same, it was like a 3-month period, like publishing the Tau Manifesto and then publishing the Ruby on Rails tutorial first edition. That's been kind of a fun little geek calling card to the point where, and it, what's interesting though is real mathematical content to it. I mean, if you read the whole thing, it's like, it's pretty dense. Like, and I wanted people with a mathematical background to read it and realize there was actual depth to it. You know, I'm not just some random crank on the internet. Like, I'm a random crank on the internet with a PhD in theoretical physics from Caltech. So like, I can bring it in terms of, like, you know, some of the mathematical content, but it was actually, there was a big overlap with my entrepreneurial stuff because I perceived that there was a market for this. And I also felt like I understood the dynamics of why it would succeed. And so one of the things I noticed, and this is really just the last like 20 years or so, there's become like sort of a self-conscious sort of geek nerd culture. People who wear nerdy t-shirts or the kind of people who wear a Pi t-shirt, for example, they are also humans, and humans have a tendency to want to one-up each other if they can, right? Like, there are a lot of status games in human society. And I realized that Tau is basically a way for people to one up each other in like this sort of little geek status game of like, oh, you think that Pi is nerdy? Well, let me tell you about Tau. So I knew I was going to be kind of recruiting that dynamic. And essentially I was kind of thinking of it as a product. Like, how can this succeed in the marketplace of ideas as a product? Like, it wasn't, you know, I mean, I did a little money off of selling t-shirts, but you know, that's not why I did it. It was not a startup, but it actually followed a lot of the same principles in the sense of like, there was, I was unusually well qualified to do it. The timing was right. And I felt like I had a good understanding of the market. So it's actually like very similar to the other things I've done. Once I kind of figured out some of these principles as an entrepreneur, you know, after my 2 failed startups.
Well, and it fits kind of, you know, Kevin Kelly's 1,000 True Fans and a few others, you know, and there's unfortunate effects of this too in our society, but it's like find your tribe and then actually significantly delineate them from others, right? Whereas that didn't used to be the way we did it, but, you know, it's effectively the long tail approach to especially more niche areas. So yeah, I love it. And, you know, I'll just share my little tie-in here because on Pi Day this past year, I work at the Wikimedia Foundation, you know, these fit this tribe, and somebody said something about Pi Day. And then one of our hardcore math people that I work with said, yeah, but do you know about Tau Day? And went on this and they linked your thing. And I read it on Pi Day. I was like, oh, that's interesting. Ha ha, I get it. And then here enough, I'm looking at your profile and I'm like, oh, holy cow, I'm about to go interview the Tau Day guy. So
because there's an overlap with the Rails tutorial to a certain degree, every once in a while, someone who knows about both will put them together and realize like, wait a minute, like mind blown. It's like worlds colliding. So it is kind of funny to like you went through that same experience. And they're actually quite different. I mean, they're, you know, both obviously technical, but the tone is very different. Like the Rails tutorial and all the learning stuff is like, I get a lot of feedback. I'm happy about this. And people feel like the tutorials are supportive, but they also have high standards. Like they don't let you off the hook as a student. Like they expect you to be able to do it. It's like, and I feel like the best instructors I had were like this. You felt like, okay, I can't just coast in this class because this professor expects me to do well. So I feel like there's an instructional tone to the Learn Enough tutorials and to the Rails tutorial. And the Tau Manifesto is partially an experiment in adapting that tone to something that's really a polemic. And that's part of the reason I think people don't recognize the writing necessarily, or it's because the tone is so different that they don't realize that it's the same person.
And I think I'm concluding here too, Michael, is that you don't actually not like Pi. It's the number 2 you object to.
I know. I object to the combination. Pi by itself is not an important number. The important number is the ratio of the circumference to its radius. And then in some context, there's a factor of a half, and you should just write that as half tau instead of writing it as pi.
We are near the end here, and I want to finish up. I want to ask you to put on your mentoring hat. You've got a lot of good lessons in the show already, but kind of bring it all together for me. What's your one or two best bits of career advice, those things that you know you wish 22-year-old Michael or 18-year-old Michael knew?
I would give the advice that Paul Graham gave in an essay he wrote that he was going to talk to, I think it was a high school, but they decided he didn't have institutional affiliation. So if he said something controversial, they couldn't get him fired, basically, something like that. They didn't have any leverage on him. And so I think they got scared about like having this sort of this independent thinker giving a talk. So in the PG's essay, he talks about giving yourself the most options. You want to always be sailing upwind. I think he gave an example of like, if you have to choose between, say, like majoring in economics or mathematics, you should choose mathematics, because if you major in economics and want to go to math grad school, you're going to have a tough time. But if you major in mathematics and want to go to economics grad school, those doors are open. So I would say, like, it's really hard to predict ahead of time how things are going to go. Be doing things that are sort of generally in the direction you want to go, and then be surprised where you end up. If you keep pushing in the good direction that makes sense based on, you know, your particular interests and skills and so on, and you're always giving yourself lots of options, things are much more likely to work out. Like coming out of the Rails tutorial, I started a company that made a publishing platform that we thought maybe this will be valuable. People can publish their products on it and we can take a cut of the sales. If that doesn't work out, we have a great option, which is just to use that same platform to make the LearnIt tutorials that we've been thinking about for a while. And so, you know, and the publishing platform didn't become a major profit center for us. We had a good thing to go into. So I think if you look for things that will give you the most options, it's really hard to go wrong.
Yeah, I love that so much. Such good advice there, especially for someone who said he doesn't want to give advice. So really good nugget in there, though, for our listeners. I would encourage them. And I know, like, for me too, like, you know, this is one of the things, like, you love about Silicon Valley. I know we're both not there, but like, you get exposed to so many options. And that is one of the true factors. It's not so much that there's tech there. It's that there's so many options for tech that you can, in a very short span of time, go explore so many different things.
But I feel like the internet has changed the game, and remote work is going to become increasingly important and a good option. You know, it's a company that I actually knew them before they went through Y Combinator, which I think now they are doing remote things at YC, but they historically have required you be on site. But there's a company that you may have heard of called GitLab. It's a Rails app, sort of as a GitHub style application, and they built a whole bunch of other things on top of that. But GitLab, as I said, they went through Y Combinator, which, you know, required them to co-locate, is a remote only company. And I think we're increasingly going to be seeing things like that. So I would say, like, Silicon Valley is increasingly virtual, and it's really awesome. It's like, you can be anywhere in the world. I mean, one of the things that I think we added a scholarship program at LearnEnough, we get applications from all over the world. You know, there's no way that 20 years ago they could have had access to the kinds of things they have now. There's just no way. And so I think that don't all move to Silicon Valley. Realize that Silicon Valley is on the web, and you can find it with a web browser, which is really, it's really amazing.
Point taken, totally spot on. It's that idea of that I think you really hit on, of get exposure to as many ideas, and then that gives you options. Michael, it's been awesome to hear your story and have you on the show. I mean, so many good things in there. I think about, you know, like your path through VC land, Y Combinator, and then this medium risk, medium reward, this serendipity of writing this thing on the side that turned into your business. Last question, where can our listeners learn more from you, follow you on social media, get in touch, buy a course to help them learn enough to be dangerous?
Yeah. So I'm M. Hartle, just first initial, last name, on like pretty much everywhere. I'm most active on Twitter when it comes to social media. There's a Rails tutorial account, LearnEnough as well. LearnEnough.com is like the umbrella, and then RailsTutorial.org has the original Rails tutorial. But like, in terms of like the main product offerings are at LearnEnough.com, and you can find out about me, MichaelHartle.com or M. Hartle on Twitter.
That's awesome. And we will be sure to link those up in the show notes for our listeners. Michael, thank you again so much for joining me today.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Developmentor podcast. If you like the show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Even better, please leave us a review. If you want to hear older episodes, leave feedback, or sign up to be a guest, please visit us at developmentor.com. If you'd like to support the show, there are three ways you can help out. 1. Make a donation via Patreon. 2. If you're a software engineer looking for your next gig and wanting to practice interviewing, use our referral link to the interviewing.io platform. And 3. Buy your next tech book from Manning Publications using our affiliate link. All of those links can be found at developmentor.com/support-us. That's SUPPORT-US, all one word. Most importantly, if you like this show, please tell your friends. Referrals are the lifeblood of any podcast. Finally, we here at Developmentor hope that each and every episode helps you move one step closer to finding your path.